Welcome to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots, and now partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. Fannie Mae has announced the Deed for Lease program. Fannie Mae is implementing the Deed for Lease program under which qualifying homeowners facing foreclosure will be able to remain in their homes by signing a lease in connection with the voluntary transfer of the property back to the lender. The new program is designed for borrowers who do not qualify for or have not been able to sustain other loan workout solutions, such as a modification. Under the trademarked Deed for Lease program, borrowers transfer their property to the lender by completing a deed in lieu of foreclosure and then lease back the house at a market rate. To participate in the program, borrowers must live in their home as their primary residence and must be released from any subordinate liens on the property. Tenants of borrowers in this circumstance may also be eligible for leases under the program. Borrowers or tenants interested in a lease must be able to document that the new market rental rate is no more than 31% of their gross income. Leases under the new program may be up to 12 months, with the possibility of term renewal or month-to-month extensions after that period. A deed for lease property that is subsequently sold includes an assignment of the lease to the buyer. This is part of the Single Family Public Housing Program. Some attorneys have commented that this has the potential to be a good program. The family can stay in the home at an affordable price, and they can keep their children in the same schools and neighborhood without disruption. The economy as a whole also benefits through the reduction of distressed foreclosure sales. This can help stabilize home prices. Finally, the community benefits by not having a vacant property with overgrown weeds. On the other side, however, one of the challenges is that borrowers must be released from any subordinate liens on the property. Without more data on this point, it's hard to know exactly what the outcome will be for many borrowers who are likely to have subordinate liens and judgment liens against their property, which would obstruct getting into this program. While deeds in lieu of foreclosure do exist these days, the reality, however, is that many borrowers have additional liens against their property, so they would not be entitled to this program, unless, of course, they could pay off those liens, which seems highly unlikely. During the first week of November, the Senate and House passed legislation to extend jobless benefits at least 14 weeks nationwide. The count was 403-12 in the House. The nays comprised mostly conservative Republicans who opposed the tiny employer surtax that will fund the benefit extension. The bill will provide an additional 14 weeks of unemployment insurance in every state, with an extra 6 weeks going to folks in the 27 states where jobless rates have topped 8.5%. This means that they will be able to survive, according to House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer, Democrat from Maryland, who added, not thrive, but survive. The proposal also extends a popular $8,000 tax credit for new home buyers, while allowing businesses to recover taxes they've paid in the last 5 years to compensate for more recent losses. The bill now moves to the White House, where President Obama has vowed to sign it into law quickly. On another front, 15 public companies filed for bankruptcy in the month of October, which brings the year-to-date total through October 31st to be 181 public company bankruptcy filings. And from Lee Christie, CNNMoney.com staff writer, foreclosures have hit the worst 3 months of all times. Despite concerted government-led and lender-supported efforts to prevent foreclosures, the number of filings hit a record high in the third quarter. They were the worst 3 months of all time, according to RealtyTrack spokesman Rick Sharga. During that time, 937,840 homes received a foreclosure letter, whether a default notice, auction notice, or bank repossession, according to RealtyTrack, the online marketer of foreclosed homes. That means one in every 136 U.S. homes were in foreclosure, which is a 5% increase from the second quarter and a 23% jump over the third quarter of 2008. Nevada continued to be the worst-hit state, with one filing for every 23 households. But even tranquil Vermont, where the foreclosure crisis has barely brushed the housing market, saw foreclosure filings jump nearly 170% compared with the third quarter of 2008. Still, that resulted in just one filing for every 5,023 households in the state, the best record in the country. The RealtyTrack report also unveiled the results for September, and it found that there was slight relief from foreclosure filings. In September, notices totaled 343,638, down 4% compared with August. Unfortunately, that total accounts for 87,821 homes that were repossessed by lenders. That deluge contributed significantly to the quarter's record of 237,052 repossessions, a 21% jump from the previous 3 months. So far this year, lenders have taken back 623,852 homes. Now, real estate owned, or REO, is a property that goes back to the mortgage company after an unsuccessful foreclosure auction. REO activity increased from the previous quarter in all but two states and the District of Columbia, indicating that lenders may be starting to work through some of the pent-up foreclosure inventory caused by legislative delays, loan modification efforts, and high volumes of distressed properties, said RealtyTrack's CEO in a prepared statement. Most disturbing is that all foreclosures, not just repossessions, are rampant despite efforts to corral them. Not only has the Obama administration's Making Home Affordable foreclosure prevention program taken a bite out of REOs, but lenders themselves have scaled back repossessions over the past few months to give the program time to work. And in some low-price markets, lenders simply aren't following through on foreclosures. According to Rokakis, treasurer for Cuyahoga County in Iowa, which includes Cleveland, he said they'll even set the date for the sheriff's sale, but they don't file the final papers. They hold it in abeyance and let the residents stay in the house. In ever more frequent cases, delinquent borrowers want out of the mortgage worse than the lenders. There are no firm statistics for it, but many industry watchers claim the percentage of REOs caused by borrowers voluntarily walking away from their homes is skyrocketing. A study of the trend by Chicago Booth School of Business and Kellogg School of Management determined that when home price declines drop home values 10% below the mortgage balances, people start to give up their homes. When a negative equity approaches 50%, 17% of households default, even when they can still afford the mortgage payments. And the foreclosure crisis may not diminish anytime soon. The fastest area is in the 180 days late plus category, the most seriously delinquent borrowers, according to the experts. It's going to be a lingering problem. In addition, the RealtyTrack statistics may underestimate the depth of the foreclosure mess because lender and government actions have delayed many filings. As a result, some delinquencies have not been counted on the foreclosure tallies. That means the crisis may not end quickly. And because there are so many delinquent borrowers, it is likely the banks will be slow to take back their properties and put the repossessed homes back on the market. According to the RealtyTrack spokesperson, it's hard to envision the banks putting millions of properties up for sale and cratering prices. Recovery will be slow and gradual. I don't see home prices getting much better until 2013. And that's from an Associated Press article. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now for the second part of the show. Over the last month or so, I've been looking at a concept called the two-income trap. This is from Professor Elizabeth Warren, and I always start with some points that the credit for the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs goes to Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, who are really two of America's leading champions for debtors. I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth, and a book called The Two-Income Trap, which I do use right now as a textbook for many of the concepts and ideas on these recent shows. You can also go to the archives at www.kruufm.com, look under Life and Debt, and you can review all of the shows which deal with many issues regarding debt, helping you with your budget, and really are a thorough and basic educational program, one building on the other, to help you deal with your debt and your finances. Now, most recently, I've been talking about what Professor Warren calls the overconsumption myth, and a lot of data that she collected regarding the concept of American consumption. When she analyzed all of the information since the 1970s, it turns out that, in fact, middle-class Americans are not really frittering away their money. What we're spending money on, those categories have changed over the decades, but there really isn't any statistical basis for the myth of overconsumption. As was reported, America's myth is held on to because it is supported not by hard evidence, but by an internal comfort people use to explain away some very bad news. Those who aren't in any way overconsuming and they have that firsthand personal knowledge and experience, it's actually easier for them to just apply the myth against those people who seem to be in financial trouble. As Professor Warren indicates, if families are to blame for their own failures, then the rest of us bear no responsibility for helping those who are in trouble. Their fault is their problem. We just joined the chorus of experts advertising the financial failures to simplify the entire financial debacle. She certainly does not believe this. And in the current economy in the last 2 years, we see how the banks have had a very manipulative role in creating the huge financial problems that we are having. Yet there still is this fundamental advice that if
people stay away from consuming things they really don't need, then the credit card balances will vanish, bankruptcy filings will disappear, and mortgage foreclosures will cease to plague America. Well, in reality, it's not nearly so neat. Certainly, there are some families who buy too much stuff, and we may be sometimes doing that, but there is no evidence of any
epidemic
in overspending. Certainly, nothing that could explain a 255% increase in the foreclosure rate. And that was before the last 2 years when this data was analyzed. And the foreclosure rate has now gone to the highest level of all time. Or the 430% increase in the bankruptcy rolls and a 570% increase in credit card debt. There's no doubt that a growing number of families are in terrible financial trouble. But no matter how many times the accusation is thrown at the people, according to Professor Warren, overconsumption is not the reason. And her conclusion is based on data. So where did the money go? If these people aren't spending themselves into oblivion on designer jeans and DVDs, how did the middle-class families get into so much financial trouble? Well, we have to start quite literally at home. The home is the most important purchase for the average middle-class family. To the overwhelming majority of Americans, home ownership stands out as the single most important component of, quote-unquote, the good life. And there's some good reasons for this. Homes mark the lives of the family, the children, and really set out the world that the family and kids live in. The location of the home determines whether there are computers in their classrooms, in the local schools, whether there are sidewalks for the kids to ride bikes on, for example, and whether the front yard is a safe place to play. A home in America will consume more of the family's income than any other purchase. More than food, more than cars, more than health insurance, more than childcare. And in recent decades, it costs more to buy a home than it used to. And it turns out that the overwhelming majority of middle-class parents are homeowners rather than renters.
Although with the current foreclosure rate, this percentage may be changing.
Now, in the late 1980s, several expert commentators predicted a really spectacular collapse in the housing market. Economists reasoned that baby boomers were about to become empty nesters, so pressure on the housing market would undergo a sharp reversal. According to the experts, housing prices would reverse their 40-year upward trend and drop during the 90s and 2000s anywhere from 10 to 47%. It is true that the average size of a new home has increased by nearly 40% over the past generation, although it's still less than 2,200 square feet. There are some details to consider. The overwhelming majority of middle-income families don't live in one of those very spacious new homes. In fact, the proportion of families living in older homes has increased by nearly 50% over the past generation, leaving a lot of us grappling with deteriorating roofs, peeling paint, and old wiring. Today, nearly 6 out of 10 families own a home that is more than 25 years old, and nearly a quarter own a house that is more than 50 years old. So that concept of the home becoming a 6,000 square foot contemporary on a 3-acre panoramic lot or a gutted and rehabbed townhouse in a gentrified ghetto is not by any
review of the facts.
The concept that most, actually the vast majority of Americans
have or
deal with as owners. A lot of it has to do with the marketing and the image making. But despite all the hoopla over the highly visible status symbols of the well-to-do, the size and amenities of the average middle-class family home have increased only modestly. The median owner-occupied home grew from 5.7 rooms in 1975 to only 6.1 rooms in the late 90s.
Which is just an increase of less than half of a room in more than 2 decades. And interestingly enough, what was the half room used for? An exercise room? A media room? Some other exotic use of space? Well, Professor Warren discovered no.
The data showed that most often the extra room was a second bathroom or a third bedroom. These are improvements, but the averages show that the middle-class family in a six-room house has hardly placed themselves into a mansion. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And we've been talking about the overconsumption myth and some vital facts which indicate that the major economic problems in Americans' lives are not based on overconsumption. First, we just concluded that it's the price of homes for middle-class Americans being a major factor in the challenges that have been experienced financially. Moreover, the rise in housing costs has become a family problem. Home prices have grown across the board, particularly in large urban areas, but the brunt of the price increases has fallen on families with children. Professor Warren's analysis showed that the median home value for the average childless couple increased by 26% between 1984 and 2001, which is an impressive rise in less than 20 years. And just for the record, that these figures are adjusted for inflation. Now, for married couples with children, however, housing prices shot up 78% during this period. In other words, three times faster. Putting it in dollar terms, in 1984, the average married couple with young children owned a house worth $72,000. Now, less than 20 years later, a similar family bought a house worth $128,000, which is an increase of more than $50,000. This kind of growing cost made a big, big dent in the family budget, as monthly mortgage costs made a similar kind of jump, despite falling interest rates. No matter how Professor Warren took the data and cut it, couples with children are spending more than ever on housing. That leads to a very fundamental question. Why would the average parent spend so much money on a home? If we try to use the overconsumption theory, that really doesn't offer many insights. We don't think that families with children have a particular love affair with bathroom spas and professional kitchens, while the swinging singles are really content to live in Spartan apartments with outdated kitchens and closet-sized bathrooms. And that's not going to be what happened at all. In the two-income trap, Professor Warren looks at a couple of other factors. She concludes that for many parents, the answer came down to two words which are so powerful that families would pursue them to the brink of bankruptcy. And what are those words? Those words are safety and education. Safety and education. Families have put mom to work, used up the family's economic reserves, and took on crushing debt loads to attain safety and education. Parents are hoping to offer their children the best possible start in life. Now, parents generally will agree that they want their child to go to a good school, and they often scramble to find those schools, particularly in big cities, but even in small places. The way school districts are divided up, families often prefer one school over another. Politicians who can't agree on much of anything agree that there is a major problem in America's public schools. Just going back to the election in the year 2000, the presidential candidates from both political parties were each promoting their policies for new educational programs. And there was a very, very good reason for this, because a recent poll had been completed and it showed that education now ranks as the voters' single highest priority for increased federal spending, higher than health care, research on AIDS, environmental protection, and even fighting crime. When we just think about it, we've all either heard about or had personal experience with the young people who can't read, with the horrific gang violence in schools, with classrooms that don't have the proper textbooks, and drug dealers and sex offenders at school doors. Now we're talking about the 21st century here. Now, one of the root causes of this, along, of course, with educational policies, there is an association of the evils in school with poverty. Helping failing schools really was and is helping, by and large, schools in the poorest neighborhoods. When we take it to the bottom line, all this, even with educating middle-class children, most of whom have been fairly lucky enough to avoid the worst failings of the public school system, is related to money. According to Professor Warren, failing schools impose an enormous cost on those children who are forced to attend the school, but they also inflict an enormous cost on those students who don't. A lot of middle-class parents, particularly in major metropolitan areas, do spend an enormous amount of time, money, and effort finding a slot for their child in a decent school, that is, a private school, or as we have been suggesting, a portion of the school district where there is the finer school, resulting usually in moving in that sector of the school district. Many kids have left the public school system altogether, opting for private, parochial, or homeschooling, particularly if they are not in the part of the school district with the finer public school. But when Professor Warren looked at all of the data, she concluded that private schools and strategic maneuvering go only so far, and that for most middle-class parents, ensuring that their children get a decent education translates into one very important thing: getting a home in the small subset of school districts that have managed to hold on to a reputation of high quality and parent confidence. A study conducted in Fresno, California, with about 400,000 residents, found that for similar homes, school quality was the single most important determinant of neighborhood prices, more important than racial composition of the neighborhood, commute distance, crime rate, or proximity to a hazardous waste site. Another study in suburban Boston, for example, showed the impact of school boundary lines. Two homes located less than half a mile apart and similar in nearly every aspect will command significantly different prices if they are in different elementary school zones. Once again, where the kids go to school determines the value of the home. In another study, schools that scored just 5% higher on fourth grade math and reading tests added a premium of nearly $4,000 to nearby homes, even though these homes were virtually the same in terms of neighborhood character, school spending, racial composition, tax burden, and crime rate. Another example is University City, the West Philadelphia neighborhood surrounding the University of Pennsylvania. In an effort to improve the area, the university committed funds for a new elementary school. Well, the results at the time of the announcement, the median home value in the area was less than $60,000. 5 years later, homes within the boundaries now go for about $200,000, even if they need to be totally renovated. The neighborhood is otherwise pretty much the same. Same commute to work, same distance from the freeways, and the same old houses. And yet, in 5 years, families are willing to pay more than triple the price for a home just so they can send their kids to a better public elementary school. Just like the real estate agents always joked, the three things that matter in determining the price of a house are location, location, location. Professor Warren has updated the mantra to schools, schools, schools. And we will continue investigating into this phenomena next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM.
Penn, the voice in Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.